Welcome to Two Dope Boys in a Podcast. I'm Phil McKenzie. This week, we only have half of the dynamic duo, one of the two dope boys. Shout out, of course, to my brother in dopeness, Michael Brooks, who couldn't make it this time around. But I'm going to hold down the fort for this On Point. And On Point is where we highlight someone getting it right. And I'm really excited because we're joined by Professor Timothy Snyder of Yale University. He's a prolific author and historian. He's written books like Bloodlands, Black Earth, and most recently On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. And we're going to be spending most of our time discussing that work. And with no further ado, Professor, how are you?
I'm doing really well. Glad to talk to you.
Thank you so much for joining us from sunny Yale University.
The sun is actually shining. I have flowers out my window. So
awesome.
Yeah, it's
awesome.
Lovely here.
Yeah. The flowers, the sun, not always the lightest of topics, but we're going to do our best to inform. On Tyranny is a great work. I had the opportunity to go through it very recently, and sort of, I guess the best place for us to start is for you to just set the stage for what was your rationale and what was the reasoning behind publishing the book.
Yeah, I guess you got to think of three overlapping experiences. There's the deep, long experience of me becoming a historian of Eastern Europe and of some of the darker chapters of European history, of the terror of Stalinism, of the Holocaust, of me learning the languages, spending time with the sources, spending time with the witnesses, trying to figure out how humans can do terrible things to other human beings. And the second level is having teachers, having people who lived through communism, who lived through National Socialism, of coming to be their friends as I became a historian and understanding their stories and learning from them and learning from their teachers. And then the third level, as I've gotten a little older, is having students myself from Eastern Europe, people from Russia or Ukraine or now even Poland or Hungary, who were told that the future was going to be democracy and freedom, but whose own life, you know, as they enter their 20s, has been something else. And I've tried to learn from them as they've resisted turns towards authoritarianism in their country. Those are the three things that are in the background when, in November, Mr. Trump wins the election. And I thought, well, this is going to be a moment which is going to surprise people, shock people, force people into stunned inaction. And for those Americans, this is all me thinking in November, for those Americans who want to do something but don't know what to do, coming up with some kind of concentrated, you know, dense, short, brief, concise list of how other people who have faced similar challenges in the past reacted might be helpful. So within a few days after the election, I wrote the 20 lessons that are the heart of the book. And then a couple of weeks later, I put in the history behind each of the 20 lessons.
Do you think that, you know, the fact that most of the time when people think about things like tyranny and fascist states, they are removed from the common person's perception of being an American construct. Obviously, we have not existed in those states in the same way the Eastern European states that you described have. Do you think that's partially why it's difficult for people to grasp the moment that we might be in?
Yeah, I mean, we have problems. We have cultural problems, you know, or we have the vices of our virtues. I mean, most of the time, you know, those ideas that America's always been a democracy, or institutions will save us, or whatever. Most of the times, those are harmless mistakes. But we're at a moment where those are not harmless mistakes, and they are mistakes. I mean, I think in our history, we've gotten lucky at a number of points where other people have been unlucky. And the point for me is to try to be humble, and rather than saying, hey, we're Americans, we get things right, we should be teaching everybody else, there are moments when, you know, you just can't say you've gotten everything right, and you should be trying to learn from other people. So, yeah, one of the things that's maybe a little bit different about me is that although I'm American, you know, and I come from here, I come from the Midwest, I can throw a curveball, all that. I'm looking at America from the outside. I've spent much of my adult life in other places where not having democracy, not having freedom is normal. And my friends in those places are, you know, if anything, maybe a little bit more impressive on average, I got to say it, than my friends here when it comes to being devoted to these values that we say we care about. So I'm not an American exceptionalist. I don't think we have automatic responses to all this. And I take it one step further. when we say it can't happen here, you know, what we're really doing is we're greasing the wheels. We're making it more likely for it to happen here. Because there do come moments where, you know, your inaction becomes a kind of action, and telling yourself a story becomes part of telling the larger story of how it's normal for us to slip away from being a free society. So yeah, we've got lots of problems, and I think some of those problems are now on free display. And in order to get over them, I think the first step is to recognize that maybe you're not quite as special as you thought you were, and to shift your view and to try to learn from others. That's in any event what the book is about.
I think it's really interesting that you mentioned your personal experience, i.e. kind of grew up in the traditional, you know, Midwest, you know, United States experience, but had an opportunity to, I guess, let's say, broaden those horizons, for lack of a better term. And one of my notes when I was thinking about this was this idea of fascist states and the shock of that for what I would say, like, you know, most mainstream Americans. But then I compared that to the experience of communities of color, you know, places that have been, let's call them, maligned communities. My personal experience, my family's family of immigrants, you know, I was born here, but, you know, the American exceptionalism thing, I'm like, meh, I'm West Indian, you know, it doesn't really capture me in the same way. But
yeah,
when I think about the, not just the Trump experience, but when I think of my closest communities, again, those communities of color, women, people that are marginalized to a certain extent, they don't have that issue of thinking like the worst is yet to come. Like, many of my friends very early on were like, yeah, this motherfucker Trump's gonna win, you know, because yeah, they were kind of felt that, you know, we've seen the worst of this, so this won't surprise us. You know, have you come across that sort of comparative?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. No, there's a lot going on in that question. Let me try to get at some things that I think are really interesting. I mean, for me personally, which is where you start, it is really interesting, you know, cause like the way that the election racialized the world for me, or added a level of racialization to the world for me, was that now I walk around New Haven and like, I look at black folks and I think, well, that's probably somebody who didn't vote to end my republic, you know, and I look at white people and I think, that's somebody who could have voted to end my republic, right? It's changed, you know, it's added this level of how I look at the world, which I would, you know, rather not have, but which is definitely there. Second thing is about knowledge. I mean, it's, so when I work on European history, but I don't work on the nice parts. I work on the worst parts. And my own bias as a historian is that if you want to understand what Europe is really about, you don't start with, you know, the baguettes, and you don't start with the Magna Carta. You know, you start with Ukraine, you start with hunger, you start with the Holocaust. You figure out the worst parts. You figure out the colonization. You figure out the genocide. Then you work backward from there. And I'm not an American historian, but I have the same basic gut feeling, which is that if you want to understand American history, you have to start from the African American history and work outward from there, rather than the other way around. You know, and so when I hear African American friends, and it's been interesting, like since the election, for some reason, you know, I've been hanging out a lot more with African Americans than beforehand.
Welcome to the
but
crew.
When I hear African American friends say, like, yeah, we thought this was coming, I get that, you know, that they're one of the group of African Americans, are one of the people, along with people who work on bad parts of European history, along with people who have seen this happen in their own countries, who thought this was plausible. And there's something important to recognize about that.
Yeah, man. Well, like I said, welcome to the crew. We're always.
But Neil, can I interrupt? There's like,
yeah,
one
go
thing
for it.
There's one thing you guys got wrong though, which is like, it can't get any worse. That's wrong, right? I mean, like when people, like I go to talks with their African Americans and they say like what you just said to me, like, okay, you know, and that's kind of nice. But like the thing is, it can get a lot worse, right? Like it's not just that like you guys know what it's going to be like. It's that it can get much worse for everybody than any of us can imagine. You know, that's just the thing that I would add. All
yeah,
right, sorry, go ahead. I interrupted you.
No, we got to keep our imagination like designed for what can be terrible. You know, but it leads me into some of the specific lessons themselves. And you know, just a couple of them really stuck out to me, and they're going to sound innocuous, I think, maybe to a listener who hasn't read the book, and obviously I strongly advise everyone listening to do that. But two of them in particular that I feel are kind of connected. One is the make eye contact and small talk, and the other is to establish a private life. And in our, we have an insights document that we publish on our website where we talk about analog culture, this concept of moving away from everything being so data-driven and making more one-to-one or personal relationships around cultural exchange. And that led me to think about those two of your lessons in particular. Like, can you kind of walk us through a little bit about what you mean about the importance of that eye contact, small talk, establishing a private life specifically?
Yeah, I mean, when I look at it in the most general way, you know, when I look at what happened to us in 2016 in the most general way, I see it as a victory of the unreal over the real. You know, not that Hillary Clinton was perfect in every way, by no means. And not that I don't understand some of the reasons why people voted for Mr. Trump. Sometimes I do. But it's the first time, I think, where the internet mattered more than real life. You know, and when the internet matters more than real life, it didn't go the way that many people expected. It's not new technology don't automatically make us more enlightened. And we should know this. I mean, that the printing press became a nice technology after 150 years of religious war, and you know, the radio became a nice technology after 15 years of fascism. It takes a while for us to settle in with these new communications technologies. And what I found, you know, and this is anecdotal now from trying to talk to people who voted for the candidate I didn't vote for, is that this, what people were for the first time kind of annoyed that they had to talk to a real person. For the first time, their main experience was, you know, down in the basement facing the screen, getting their political views affirmed, and, you know, getting fed fake news very consciously. And I don't, so the small talk is all about that. You know, the small talk is about trying to get out into the real world and making sure that we communicate, not because we convince each other, we almost never do, but sometimes we plant a seed. And the private life is about making sure that, you know, that your whole, all the things that are important to you aren't open to everyone else. If they are, you're going to be exhausted all the time, and you're going to be vulnerable when you get into politics, or vulnerable when you get into everyday life. And the third one, which is in the same vein, if you don't mind me mentioning it, is the one about practicing corporeal politics, which just means getting your body out there. You know, the test of what we do on the internet is, does it get us out into the real world? You know, does Facebook make us lead to FaceTime? Does tweeting lead to meeting? Can we get ourselves out into the real world? If it's serving as a means to that end, then maybe it's worthwhile. Because once we get out into the real world, a number of things happen. You know, we hear views that we don't expect. We're forced to react to them in real time. We can't escape. You know, you can't log out of the real world. It's still there. And when you protest, when you march, you know, you also feel a different way. You feel like you're doing something. And that feeling of doing something, as opposed to just the feeling of being right. You know, one of the things that I think is worse about the internet is that people are always right all the time. You know, you never have to take responsibility for anything. You just have to feel like you're right, and then you run away. If you're out in the real world, you don't just get to be right all the time, you know, but you do feel a lot better. You feel like you're changing things. And that's that the psychology of that seems really important to me.
I think that's a really powerful point about this idea of actual having movement, physical movement in spaces. You did mention this idea of being exhausted. I think we're in an exhausted space. I can't speak for anyone else, but just watching and listening to news and reading can be exhausting. Do you think that's a strategy used by regimes like this one to just sort of keep you confused all the time?
Oh, I'm sure it is. I mean, when there's an authoritarian regime change, one of the things that happens is that you get beaten over the head with bad news. And the news may not even be as bad as it seems, although frankly it's pretty bad. But the idea is that there's this hailstorm, and you just say, I don't want to get out of my car, you know? I'm just going to stay in here until this hailstorm is over. The idea is to numb you during those first crucial weeks and months, because it's during that beginning time when what we still do makes a difference. This is one of the points of the book. In most authoritarian regime changes, if you can just avoid consenting at the beginning, if you can do almost anything at the beginning, it's going to make a huge difference. The way that they have to work is that they get people to consent without realizing they're consenting in the first few weeks and months, and then it becomes harder to resist later on, right? So So the bad news is part of the strategy. And so you have to be able to react. You have to be able to say, okay, I'm going to limit myself to an hour of news every day. You have to say, I'm going to do something, even though what I'm doing is not going to change the whole world. I'm going to pick some place, some terrain where I feel sure of foot, and I'm going to plant something there. I'm going to start there. I'm going to meet other people who are doing things there. And that's how I'm going to make a difference. So yeah, it is definitely part of the strategy. And, you know, if I could just add one more thing, from my friends, you know, from my friends who are now younger friends who are taking part in resistance to authoritarianism elsewhere, they tend to say something which I find really interesting, which is, when they're out, so let's say they're out in a march, right? They're out of the protest where they might actually get hurt. And some of my friends have been hurt or killed. But what they say is, when I'm out there doing it, I don't feel scared. I feel scared when I come back home and turn on the television. Then I feel scared. And it seems like there's a really powerful lesson in there, you know, that it's the doing things with the other people which gives us a sense that something meaningful is happening. It's the sitting alone in front of the screen which gives us a sense that we're overwhelmed.
And alone.
And alone. Alone is really important, yeah.
You know, one of the other points I want to jump to is this idea of being kind to our language. And when you go on to set that up, you mentioned the importance of reading books. And one of the things we often talk about on the show between Michael and myself is this idea of people not having like a very long attention span. There's an inability for, like, you know, everything we read, even if it's a blog post online, has to, you know, you have to have the hashtag, you know, long read to let me know I got to scroll more than five scrolls is going to happen in this particular situation, you know. And, you know, I want to get more into that because one of the things we cited at the end of the year was actually the importance of language, like the importance of setting up definitions for things and, you know, not using the terminology and the language of the opposition to argue your points. And I'm curious about, you know, what made you frame that in the way that you did?
Well, thanks so much for that, because, you know, a lot of what I put in the book are the individual tactics that I think we have to adopt immediately. And then some of the more, I think, important parts of it, though, have to do with how we reorganize our daily lives, and not so much in terms of what we say, but in terms of how we say it. And this business of making the language work for you as opposed to having the language work on you seems to me to be really important. And it goes back a little bit to your other question about the bad news. It's not just that the bad news is bad. It's that we get filled up with certain two- and three-word constructions, which we then find ourselves using. Even people who think they're resisting Trump use his words often. And the first time they do it, they think they're joking. But before they know it, they can't get those words out of their active everyday vocabulary. So I advocate the reading as a way to carve out some time and some peace, and as a way to give your mind the material it needs to articulate the things that you ought to be thinking, but also just as a source, which is, since it's orthogonal to everyday life, since it's coming from somewhere completely different, might also give you different thoughts, and then make each citizen a specific point in a conversation rather than just being for or against. And where this comes from, I mean, to answer your question literally, it comes from me reading all the dystopic political science fiction of the middle of the 20th century, where I was really struck, you know, and Orwell makes this point and Ray Bradbury makes this point in Fahrenheit 451, that regimes that want to control minds go after books. And, you know, we know they banned it in 1984, Orwell's book. In Fahrenheit 451, Bradbury's book, there are these firemen who go from house to house and burn books. And that might seem preposterous, but the thing which strikes me about our own culture is that we're voluntarily giving up the books. You know, we're in the sea of uncertainty. We're in this froth, and we have the life rafts floating around us. And our attitude is, no, we don't want the life rafts. Let's have the froth. Let's have the drowning. You know, but we still can read. It's right in front of us. And I think, you know, a moment like now is maybe a chance to see, okay, it's very important for us to steady ourselves and steady our minds and find ways to steady others by reading the books.
There's just a couple of things I want to get to because Matt is keeping me closely on time. Matt is our producer, our wonderful producer. I want to talk about standing out, which is another one of your points, and directly connect that to the role of the artist. You know, obviously, we talk a lot about art, artists, and culture. That's the basis of everything that we do. And, you know, what is the role that you see, if any, of artists across any medium of playing in these sort of active roles of rebellion, particularly when, you know, we're seeing also attacks on the arts through official terms, government funding, but also the commodification of the art. You know, that's a whole separate show as to what the commercialization of music and film and it not being playing the role that it used to. But do you see an increased role potentially for artists as being part of that coalition of standing out of the crowd?
Yeah, very much so. And if it weren't for people who were active in the arts, I would not have been writing this book in the first place. I mean, many of my teachers and my teachers' teachers were not academics so much as playwrights or actors or other or musicians, people who were trying to have a little of the public space in a non-political way, who came to understood that in the time and place they were living, there was no non-political way, which is where we are now. I mean, that's my first point. My first point is art is now political whether we want it to be or not. We can't get away from it. There are times maybe when you can, art is an escape from politics. Now is not that time. The second thing I would say is that artists have skill sets which other people do not. And since we're in the moment that we're in, artists, I think, face a moral choice about how they're going to use those skill sets. Do I choose to communicate? Do I choose to be alone? And given all the things we've been talking about before, about how important it is to make interpersonal contact as opposed to contact over the screen, art then becomes really important. You know, whether it's the poster that's creative, that's carried during a march, or whether it's that particular construction of words, which gets into people's minds because it's different from what they're hearing every day, and also inherently beautiful. But I would make an even deeper point. I mean, I think is a deeper point, and that is that being a citizen is itself a kind of art. You know, it's not being a consumer isn't, but being a citizen is. Being able to apprehend the reality around you in terms of its manifold possibilities, you know, to get better and to get worse, to recognize just how bad things can get in the United States requires a good deal of imagination, i.e. art, and seeing how things can get better, because this is not about getting back to 2016, you know, seeing how things can get better, imagining a future, that also requires art and the artistic imagination. We can't do without that. One of the things which is happening, which is so terrible, is that this administration doesn't just recall the 1930s. It does that on purpose, and not just for historians like me. It also is depriving us of the future. It's giving us no sense of what a better America would look like. And that, you know, that's the kind of thing that where really only artists can come in and fill the gap.
Well, there it is. I'm not even going to go any further than that. The call for citizen artists, I think, is a perfect way for us to end this. Professor, I really appreciate you taking the time with us.
Hey, Phil, it's been a great pleasure. I really appreciate you reaching out. I'm glad we could do this.
Thank you so much. And that is On Point. We'll be back next week with more of Two Dope Boys in a Podcast. And as always, shout out to my brother in dopeness, Michael Brooks, and super producer, Matt Leck. Peace and love. Thanks, everybody.